You are listening to Podcasters of Horror, a podcast about exploring horror anthologies from film and TV, as part of the Super Network, with your hosts, Super Marcy.
And he just gave off, like, very creepy vibes, so you're always very unsure of this guy.
And the terrible Australian, Beat Germine.
Which, in that version, it's a Krusty the Clown doll that's harassing Homer.
This podcast may contain coarse language.
It just kept getting weirder and weirder, and it's, what the f*** is up with this house?
Adult themes.
You know, she's only just a little girl, but he really is very mean to her.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. For more information, please visit supermarcy.com or see the show notes. To show your support, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Please enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Podcasters of Horror, the podcast where we look at horror and horror adjacent anthologies from film and TV. I am one of your hosts, Super Marcy, and once again, we are stepping back into the Twilight Zone.
You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
And this is episode 37, and I am joined by my regular co-host. He is the terrible Australian, Bede Germine. Hello, Bede. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Marcy. How are you?
I'm doing well. Feeling a little twilighty in this zone, but we'll see how that goes during the course of the episode. But we are not alone. We are joined by a special guest, and it is a first-time guest on this podcast, as well as for the Super Network. So please join a good friend from Collector Creations, Julian Myers. Hello, Julian, and thanks for joining.
Hello, I like movies.
And we're making you watch TV shows.
Yeah, that's called culture.
Yes, we exactly. Are making sure you're all cultured.
Which I will note is ironic because I've seen these three episodes before.
We did each pick an episode, and it just so happens that they all go in a row in the series. But yeah, thank you so much for joining. And the episodes we will be discussing today are Mr. Denton on Doomsday, The 16mm Shrine, and Walking Distance. So, are you two ready to dive into some discussions?
Yeah,
I'm ready. Let's do this.
All right. Well, the first episode we will be discussing is Mr. Denton on Doomsday.
Wait a minute, Denton. Hey, Gunner! Hey! Where'd you get the artillery?
I found it. Found it right over there in the street.
Is that a fact?
Hey!
But it's a long time since you used one of them, isn't it, Rummy?
Yeah. A long time.
Maybe you could use it now. Yeah. Maybe you could even outdraw me.
No, I wouldn't know how to use it anymore.
Well, let's see you try. Come on, you and me will draw.
All right, Dan, cut it out.
Go
it's not
on.
Funny anymore.
Get away, Liz. The gun on me, we're going to have a showdown here.
And this is episode 3 of the series, so season 1, episode 3. This one was directed by Alan Reisner, and if I mispronounce names, I apologize. I'm Australian. I have an accent. We pronounce things differently. The episode was written by Rod Serling, and it stars Dan Duryea, Martin Landau, Jean Cooper, Malcolm Atterbury, and Doug McClure. And again, I apologized. I cannot pronounce names. The plot summary for this episode, the town drunk in the Old West faces his past when fate lends a hand. And the opening narration for this episode, as done in my most Aussie Rod Serling. Portrait of a town drunk named Al Denton. This is a man who's begun his dying early, a long, agonizing route through a maze of bottles. Al Denton, who would probably give an arm or a leg or a part of his soul to have another chance, to be able to rise up and shake the dirt from his body and the bad dreams that infest his consciousness. In the parlance of the times, this is a peddler, a rather fanciful looking little man in a black frock coat, and this is the third principal character of our story. Its function, perhaps, to give Mr. Al Denton his second chance. Now, Bede, this was your pick of episode to discuss. So what did you think of this one?
Well, yeah, I didn't know what to expect from Mr. Denton on Doomsday. Well, to be fair, the main reason why I picked this episode was because, Marcy, you picked 16mm Shrine and then Julian picked Walking Distance. I thought, just to be hilarious, I would pick either episode 3 or episode 6, so that way they just kind of all go, you know, go back to back. So I decided to go with Mr. Denton on Doomsday because I'd never heard of this episode before. I didn't know what to expect from it. And sitting down to watching it, I didn't realize it was going to be a Western episode. So I was definitely intrigued by that. And then all of a sudden, within like the first 10 seconds, Martin Landau pops up as the villain.
That really, like, he smiles, but you're like, I don't like that smile.
I mean, I love Martin Landau. We all love Martin Landau, but Martin Landau has the type of smile that looks way too big for his face.
Yeah, he's very kind of like unsettling when you see him straight away. You're like, oh,
Martin Landau is the human personification of the makeup design of the vampire from London After Midnight. That's what he looks like. Not as an insult, but that's just who he reminds me of. But when it comes to this episode, I thought, okay, it's got Martin Landau as the villain. It is a Western. Rod Serling, what have you got for me? And I got to say, watching this episode, actually watching all three episodes, they kind of have the similar kind of running theme throughout all of them. In terms of looking back on your past, talking about regret, having nostalgia. And with this one, though, you got the character of Al Denton, played by Paul Dura. And I like the fact that basically he is this man who is the town drunk, who has had this reputation of being a very famous gunslinger. And during the course of the episode, you kind of get the impression that all of his years of gunslinging, with that reputation he has had, he has killed a lot of people or injured a lot of people.
I was going to say shot a lot of people at least.
Yes, exactly. And it's very clear that whole thing has taken a toll on him, particularly one time when he accidentally killed a 16-year-old kid who wanted to fight him in a duel. And so obviously you could see that, and everyone kind of treats him as the town drunk. Even Martin Landau is like, oh, if you sing me a song, I'll buy you a drink. And so everyone does that to him in this town. And then, of course, a man by the name of Henry J. Fate, not subtle at all.
Not subtle whatsoever.
comes into town and basically kind of changes his whole perspective of things. So he gives him this tonic that if he drinks it, he's able to shoot properly within 10 seconds. So no misses or anything like that. But now he sort of realizes that the past that he is now catching up to him, people are interested in dueling him again. So he's kind of reconciling that in terms of, like, is this something he still wants to do? So he confronts that sort of aspect of himself. And then, of course, it leads to an ending, which we will talk about very soon, which kind of changes his whole output and makes him make a decision about what he wants to do with the directory of his life, but also the people around him as well, so they too don't fall into the same type of trappings as he has. So it's a very simple episode, but it definitely has a lot of interesting elements to it, which I found quite emotionally effective. So yeah, I mean, it's not one of the best Twilight Zone episodes, but I think it's a pretty solid one overall.
And Julian, Your thoughts on this episode?
I think it's always fun watching older shows like this. Like, it'll be on like the TCM Classics channel or whatever, and it'll just be like, oh, it's a classic backlot episode. We're doing the backlot stuff. And like, because of that, you don't have to worry too much about the expense of like the sets and everything. It's that's just there. It's just the location for the story. It makes you focus more on the story and the narrative, and specifically the twist that obviously happens later on. And I love the obvious name, the Mr. Fate, Henry J. Fate, the dealer in everything. I'm like, it's not a show that's not subtle. Like, it's very on the nose of everything it's doing, and I just love that about it. But I love too how, because it's only 25 minutes, you've got the characters have to be quick into their realizations, him getting this ability to just shoot and with complete accuracy, completely by mistake, and realizing that, oh, I have what I used to have. I have the source again, but then realizing this is going to have a consequence because I'm not going to be the town drunk anymore. People are going to respect me. And because of that, people are going to come to try to kill me because I'm the same person I used to be. So, again, like you were saying, it's a great reflection on the person he used to be. And as the episode progresses, you find out why he stopped being that person. And it's a simple narrative that I feel like I've seen before, but it's the effectiveness of the episode that really works. The antagonist who bullies him and everything, and how amusingly, I think, in the start of the episode, for him just accidentally having perfect rain, like perfect shot. But then by the second half of the episode, he doesn't. When he goes to train, he's a terrible shot again. So clearly, it's not his own doing, and it never was to begin with. It's just harnessing an ability he used to have. Which I like. It's fun.
Yeah, so I didn't really know anything about this episode. I hadn't seen it before. I just noticed it was kind of a Western, so that always gets my attention. I do love Westerns. So a Western episode definitely was something I was looking forward to. And it is a simple episode, but there's a lot to it. What I really liked about this episode in particular was the performances. I actually thought they were all really good. There's a moment sort of in the middle of the episode where Al Denton is like, well, if I'm gonna die, I might as well look good for it. That kind of conversation, he goes to the barber. Little moments like that always get me. Like, I find them really interesting and they just add something to it. But yeah, it is sort of a quick thing, but it's also about the reflecting on the past, which is interesting that all three episodes have that in common. And then, of course, with Mr. Henry Fate. Again, fantastic name, who comes in with that offer. And again, it's one of those things where it's like, do I need this? Should I take this? What are actually the consequences? So I think it's a interesting little but simple episode that does make you think about these things, which I really enjoyed. And again, seeing Martin Landau show up and straight away just being this like bully character was just kind of unsettling in a weird way. It's like, I don't want you to bully me because I probably would end up, if I was dealing with something like that, I would take that potion and probably mess everything up and I'd be dead because everyone's going to come after me thinking I'm the best shot around. But I like the simplicity of the episode, but the fact that it has like a deeper meaning, I think, really resonates a lot.
Well, I think also too, it's just a really interesting episode. Like, it's for me, this is definitely one where the performances and the writing are definitely the standout points. And this is not really an episode where it's kind of based around the twist, which sometimes Twilight Zone does tend to do in terms of they have it, Rod Serling will come up with a really cool twist for an episode and then build the story around it, or feels like it's building up to that twist. But I like these particular episodes where it's more about theme and character more than anything else.
Yeah, it's not reliant on sort of an ending twist, which we've sort of seen a few times looking at episodes.
But also too, it kind of does it still in a way, because when basically Denton gets this offer from this young gunfighter to want to get into a duel with him. And so, as he's waiting for him, he finds out that the young man is also using the same tonic that Mr. Fate gave him. So they both end up shooting each other, but luckily they only shoot each other's hands, so that's all good, so none of them die. In the end, what I think is very effective is, like, in a way, now that basically this young man has been shot, he's going to learn a lot of the lessons Denton himself learned later on in life, so that way he would never have to kind of raise a gun again at another human being and live with the consequences of that.
Yeah, it's one of those episodes where its twists is able to reflect on everything that you've already seen, because you know exactly what that kid would end up like if he took the tonic but the other guy didn't, if he was a great shot and the other guy wasn't. He would live this life that we've now seen our main character end up with, and you don't want that for that kid. And I like, again, like you said, it's not based on the twist, it's about the characters, it's about the story, and it builds into it really nicely. A twist that you wouldn't really see coming, because you're like, oh, clearly it's gonna, he's gonna be the gunman. It's like gonna be an ethical question. Is he gonna morally like shoot this person because he's gonna have this tonic or not? And then I love that staging of they both realize they have the tonic, and they're both like, we have to use this now. Because if we, well, they've both taken it, whatever. We have to shoot now, because if we don't, they could still kill me. There's that too much pressure for both of them. And I love the payoff. It's a great payoff.
Yeah, it's a moral story. That's what where I'm trying to go for. Where it sort of reflects on what Denton's done and how that kind of reflects the younger character and the path forward. So I think it's a different episode from at least what we've covered on the show so far. It is something a bit different. And again, like, it's not reliant on this twist. The twist of that kind of plays into the story, so it doesn't really take you out of it, so to speak. But for something that I felt was quite simple, I thought it was a very effective episode overall. Thinking of our rating and final thoughts, for me, I'd give it a 3.5 for the episode. I really enjoyed it, and it's definitely one I recommend people check out. And especially if you are like me and you like westerns, a little western episode goes a long way. So, a beat.
Yeah, I would give it about a 3.5 out of 5 as well. I think it's a really solid episode overall that definitely works due to the performances of its cast, the script itself, and also the themes that Serling is going for in this one. So I think this is one that definitely works on those fronts. Like, it's not a particularly memorable episode, but it is a solid one. Although I will admit, I was taken aback by the twist at the end, where basically a title card came up that said, "Mr. Denton will return in Avengers Doomsday." I was not expecting
And I'm still
that
waiting. I'm still waiting. Where is he? And
at
Julian, your rating and final thought?
all. Very similar to Bede, 3.5 as well. I think the performances and the story carries the story really well. Especially on a rewatch, because I had forgotten everything that happened in this episode. So I didn't even remember the twist. And it was just, it was a nice, still enough of a breath of fresh air whilst watching it on a second watch. But yeah, it's a good, charming little episode.
Yeah, it's yeah, I'd say it's worth watching. And the closing narration for the episode, Mr. Henry Fate, dealer in utensils and pots and pans, liniments and potions, a fanciful little man in a black frock coat who can help a man climbing out of a pit or another man from falling into one. Because you see, fate can work that way in the Twilight Zone. And our next episode is the 16mm shrine.
This is the world, Dan, right in here. From now on, I keep the drapes drawn and doors locked. These are the 1930s again, with all the charm and romance, all the gaiety. That was a carefree world, Danny, and I'm gonna make it that way again.
Can't. It's nostalgic, it's nice, but it's not true. It's phony.
The party. We'll invite all my friends.
Barbara, this is ridiculous. Have you forgotten? Paul Nader's been dead for 5 years. Jerry Herndon lives in Chicago. Steve Black hasn't been around for 15 years. And if I could get them, what kind of a party do you think I can invite them here? Don't you understand what you're doing? You've built yourself a graveyard here. You keep wishing for things that are dead.
And this is episode 4. So, season 1, episode 4. This one was directed by Mitchell Leeson. Again, I'm going to get names wrong, so I'm very sorry. It was, again, written by Rod Serling, and this one stars Ida Lupino, Martin Balsam, Jerome Cohen, John Clark, Alice Frost, and Ted DiCorsia. And the plot? Barbara Jean Trenton is a faded film star who lives in the past by constantly re-watching her old movies instead of moving on with her life. So her associates try to lure her out of her self-imposed isolation. And the opening narration for the episode. Picture of a woman looking at a picture. Movie great of another time. Once brilliant star in a firmament no longer part of the sky, eclipsed by the movement of earth and time. Barbara Jean Trenton, whose world is a projection room, whose dreams are made out of celluloid. Barbara Jean Trenton, struck down by hit-and-run years of lying on the unhappy pavement, trying desperately to get the license number of fleeting fame. So I picked this episode. I basically just looked at the basic plot, and I'm like, this kind of seems a little similar to Sunset Boulevard, so why not check this one out? And yeah, it definitely has a lot of similarities, but put down into a 25-minute episode. And I really liked this one, and I think maybe it has to do with being a similar age to the character, and basically she's just being almost told, like, you're put out to pasture because you're 40. You can't have these magnificent roles anymore. You can play a mother and a side character. And we are now in 2026 and these things are still happening. So somehow it's still very timeless and very relatable. Just because you're at a certain age does not mean you fuck off and fail to exist. So this is an episode that really resonated with me and I really enjoyed it. And it's a rare episode where you have the star of the episode. In this case, it's Ida Lupino, who would go on to direct an episode of the show, which we actually discussed on the previous episode, The Masks. And that would make the only woman to have directed an episode of The Twilight Zone. And I think a rare case of someone first starring in an episode and then going on to direct an episode. Mm-hmm. And it really is her episode, and I think it's such a great and very grounded and very real and raw performance. And you actually kind of want to slap those around her as well. But you also don't want her to just be living in the past either. And that's something I really feel in the year of 2026, being so nostalgic for the 80s and 90s and even the early 2000s and just how insane life has become now. So I feel like this episode just hit me quite a lot more than an episode should. And again, this one kind of has a twist that I like, but it's also kind of sad as well. So yeah. Julian, what are your thoughts on this one?
Of the three episodes, this is my least favorite of the three. The way it affected you, Marcy, is definitely worth pointing out, because obviously I'm in a very different boat, being in my 20s and a guy, and I've already lost my look, so I don't have to worry about that part of it. It's one of those episodes that, again, because it is so similar to Sunset Boulevard, did it come out after Sunset Boulevard? I can't.
Yeah.
It did. Okay.
I believe it, yeah.
It seems like a very close time period.
Yeah, I think there is trivia about that. I don't have it up at the moment. Maybe you do, Bede?
I do. In fact, the composer of this episode, I should say, Franz Waxman, actually was the composer on Sunset Boulevard. And the director, Mitchell Leeson, actually directed a lot of Billy Wilder's scripts in the 30s before Wilder transitioned to becoming a director himself. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of Sunset Boulevard vibes throughout this whole episode.
I did like that Martin Balsam was in it, the guy who gets killed in Psycho. He's a really fun addition because it is such a small cast. There's only the four people that are in it. And I like how it reflects as well with the actor colleague that she had, who she remembers young and handsome from the films, but then when she sees him, he's old and gray and whatever, and he's like, oh, I left that impression behind me and everything. So he's just in the real world. He's moved on. It's like it was just a thing he did in his youth, and it's not important to him anymore. Whereas for her, it's so important that I'm surprised she hasn't blown up the film reels as playing them every single day, like they haven't burnt up or anything. They also looked really crisp on that projection. Gotta love it.
And bait.
Yeah, I really like this episode as well. I definitely picked up the Sunset Boulevard vibes even before learning that there are actual connections to the episode itself. But of course, like you, Marcy, I was very much intrigued by this one, knowing that Ida Lupino was the lead in this. And as you stated before, we talked about her Twilight Zone episode, The Masks, on a previous episode. I was curious to see what she would be like in front of the camera this time as an actor. I mean, I've seen her in other films and all that, and she's always great in those. And she's also equally great here too as Barbara. And I think she puts in a really empathetic performance that you can't help but feel sorry for. But at the same time, though, you kind of get why everyone is concerned about it because, I mean, it's one thing to be nostalgic for the past, but then it's another thing when you basically, it's become, I guess, your whole personality and your whole
Yeah, she's kind of
worldview.
stuck in the past rather than. That's why I think the contrast between the other character who's now older and she doesn't even recognize him because he's gotten older and he's just like moved on and she never will move on. And I think that's kind of sad, but it's also like the part of the reason is because once she got older, she just wasn't getting the work anymore, which is kind of pathetic that that's how the system is.
I do think it's interesting that her colleague doesn't do the movie stuff because it's traditional that guys will keep acting for the, like their whole lifetime, whatever, but they don't go with that route for the film. They're like, no, he's just a business guy now. He's just moved on from movies. It's not his thing, which feels like they could have gone in the other direction to emphasize how much, because she's a woman, that she's being forced into certain spots that now that she can't be in her young 20s or 30s, that she's a mother type and that's all she can be, the hagsploitation level of her career, which honestly she should have done. Fuck it, that would have been cool.
Yeah,
And I think
agree.
that's one of the interesting things about it, because there is a lot of interesting sort of themes of which Serling's script for this episode really sort of touches on in terms of her as a character, the way how she would like the world to be compared to everyone else who is concerned about her mental state. But at the same time, it still does acknowledge, like you say, Marcy, about how older actresses, especially around this time, were either just sort of basically, even if they were huge stars at the beginning of their careers, they were basically put out the pasture, given very little to no roles. And if they were given roles, they were basically given the mother roles. And we also got to remember, this is around the time where basically, as soon as you hit 30, it was like you're playing automatically mother roles.
Yeah, and as Julian mentioned, like otherwise, or you'd be in like hagsploitation type. So once you're over 35, you're a crazy old lady, basically. So I think a lot of the things in it resonated for me in particular, but it is an interesting point that the sort of the colleague actor just isn't in the business anymore. But you do see like the other people she worked with, like in the meeting, obviously still in the business, but trying to palm her off to smaller roles, and that's not kind of how she sees herself. But then we kind of get to the ending where she just enters her old movie and she's going to live in this life that's not, it's not real life. She's kind of really stuck there. And for me, that's really sad that there's no other option for her except to live in the in this past. So I feel like this is maybe one of the more sadder episodes with that kind of an ending, or it just made me feel really sad. She didn't deserve that.
Feels like they want it to be kind of like a happy ending in a way for her, because it's like, oh, she's happy now. She's where she wants to be in celluloid, just being with all the younger people. But it's also, yeah, you look at the reality of it and they're just like, yeah, it's kind of also sucks because she's just gone now.
Yeah,
She
she.
couldn't grow up in a way. Yeah, yeah, couldn't move out of that mentality.
Yeah.
She wished her way into oblivion.
Yeah, so I think it's kind of an interesting episode in that way, especially like you could see it as a happy ending, but for me it's a sad and kind of depressing. Mm.
I think they had the character who picked up the scarf, his whole thing, like, that she wished so hard that she could be there. Like, I feel like for him, that was kind of how they tried to make it seem a bit happier. Like, oh, well, because if he's okay with it, maybe it's fine. But it's like, yeah, but he's looking at it from her point of view that she's happy where she is. But in the reality of it, it's not a happy situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely not. So we'll move on to our final thoughts and rating for the episode. For me, it's almost difficult to rate because I really liked the episode. So I think I'm actually just going to go with a 4 out of 5. I think it's definitely an interesting episode, even if it is kind of riffing off something we've already seen. I think it's just something that really hit me. And maybe if I saw this even 10 years ago, I don't think it would have hit me as much. But it's just something that actually really hit me. And I think the performances as well are like really good. So I really like this one. Julian.
I was tossing and turning between 3 to 3.5 because I gave it 3.5 last time. I think I'm going to stick with that mostly because of its performances. But again, it does have a compelling enough narrative. And I think because it has such a unique ending that's the most Twilight Zone of the three endings in a way to me, like because it's so out there that you wouldn't just expect her to step into the cellulite world and that's the end of the story. And so because of that, it's like, wow, okay, that's not what I expected, but that's what makes it so Twilight Zone, is that I guess that can just happen in that universe, and that's the point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Beat.
I give it about a 3.5 out of 5 as well. I think it is, again, a solid episode that definitely, like Mr. Denton on Doomsday, is elevated by the performances and the themes that it's going for, even if it does feel familiar. And I would be surprised. I mean, I have no confirmation about this, so I could be talking out of my ass with what I'm about to say next. I would be surprised if Rod Serling did see Sunset Boulevard and basically was like, I want to kind of tackle something like that for an episode of the show. The fact that it actually has a lot of Sunset Boulevard connections, not just in terms of the plot and the themes, but also people who worked on the episode or had connections to that film as well. So I don't feel like this is just a coincidence. But I do think it is a pretty solid one. And yeah, the ending, it kind of tries to set it up as almost like a happy ending, but it does feel, when you kind of look back on it, it's more of a sad ending.
Yeah, and it does make you want to revisit Sunset Boulevard after watching
Indeed.
And the closing narration for the episode. To the wishes that come true, to the strange mystic strength of the human animal who can take a wishful dream and give it a dimension of its own. To Barbara Jean Trenton, movie queen of another era who has changed the blank tomb of an empty projection screen into a private world. It can happen in the Twilight Zone. And now for the third and final episode we are discussing for this episode, Walking Distance, which is season 1, episode 5.
You dropped this at the house. I looked inside it. It tells a great many things about you. Your driver's license, the cards, the money in it. It seems you are Martin Sloan. You're 36 years old and you have an apartment in New York City. It says your driver's license expires in 1960. That's 25 years from now. And the dates on the bills, those dates haven't happened yet either.
And you know, Pop?
Yes, I know. I know who you are. I know you've come from a long way from here. A long way and a long time. But I don't understand how or why. Do you?
Directed by Robert Stevens, written by Rod Serling. This one stars Gig Young, Frank Overton, Irene Tedrow, Michael Montgomery, Ron Howard, and Byron Fulger. A man fed up with where he is in life finds himself not only in his hometown, but back to the time when he was a boy. Now, this episode is a little different because we have an opening narration, a mid-episode narration, and a closing narration. So I'll read the opening and mid-narrations first. Martin Sloan, age 36, vice president at agency in charge of media. This is not just a Sunday drive for Martin Sloan. He perhaps doesn't know it at the time, but it's an exodus. Somewhere up the road, he's looking for sanity, and somewhere up the road, he'll find something else. And then our mid-episode narration. A man can think a lot of thoughts and walk a lot of pavements between afternoon and night. And to a man like Martin Sloan, to whom memory has suddenly become reality, a resolve can come just as clearly and inexorably as stars in the summer night. Martin Sloan is now back in time, and his resolve is to put a claim to the past. And Julian, this was your pick. So what were your thoughts on Walking Distance?
This was another one where, because I did choose this one because my serialized said that I hadn't logged it yet. So I'm like, oh, of course, I'll do that one. And then I was watching, I'm like, no, wait, I've seen this one before. This one is a nice reflection episode again. It's so heavy on the nostalgia of our Mr. Martin Sloan going to his old hometown, which was called Homewood. It's so on the nose, it hurts. Yeah. And it's he's talking about, like, oh, the old, what's the store, the ice cream, and it's all for a dime. He's so heavy on his nostalgia that he doesn't even realize he's in the past. Mm-hmm. But I love the, when he, as at the start of the episode, he pulls up at the petrol station to, or the gas station in America, to get his car fixed up. And it's like, ah, it's a mile and a half to walk to this place. That won't take long. And I love how when he's walking towards it, you're watching him through the mirror. So it's immediately a heavy on the reflection motif. And there's several mirrors and verbal references to him looking at himself throughout the whole entire episode. But yeah, even like the store he goes to where he gets his ice cream, that
three
even
scoops.
Has a three scoops. That's got a huge mirror in it as well, where he's looking at himself eating this meal. There's he runs into a young kid who's playing marbles, and he remembers marbles that he used to play and the kind of marbles he used to get. There's the his house is literally right across the street. Like the same childhood house he grew up on, everything is the same until he realizes that, hey, it is all the same. Dun dun. And that's the twist. So, like, you get the twist early on, which is really fun. So then it's him realizing it and how does he deal with it? And it kind of becomes a, so why is he here? What is the point of it? And what ramifications could his presence ensue? Because it's like, is it a weird dream sequence or is it real?
Yeah.
And I like that.
I mean,
yeah.
It's the Twilight Zone, so it's a bit of
both. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I know we've talked about doing this episode for a while on this show, Marcy. And it's interesting looking into this episode because this, I think for a lot of people, is up there as one of the best episodes of the series. Even Time Magazine rated it as the 9th best Twilight Zone episode of all time. You can definitely see why, because there's definitely a lot of interesting themes going on. And again, kind of similar to the previous two episodes we discussed, it also too looks at nostalgia, regrets, and living in the past. But I think in this case, though, it kind of ends on a more hopeful note about not forgetting the things that made you happy, not just leave them in the past, but find something like that for your future, which I think is a really good kind of message for the episode to end on. And that way we can just not have to live in the past all the time. So it's kind of interesting after these kind of, this episode, it's kind of like the message after all these three episodes back
to back. It's almost like the same side of the coin type of thing between this and the previous episode in that regard. And like for me, this is probably my favorite of the three. I really loved this episode. I think just how it unfolds and you kind of get the idea that he is revisiting this past like 20 years ago or 30 years ago was really interesting. And it does, as you say, it comes early that this is in the past and he kind of sees his past self and then he speaks to his younger parents. The scenes like that actually really, really got to me a lot. When he's more towards the end of the episode where he speaks to his father, who tells him he needs to leave. I thought like that was just so well done, so beautifully written with the dialogue as well. But again, like it's an episode that kind of hits hard because again, there's just so, I've said this for every freaking thing, it's 2026. We are being very nostalgic for a lot of things that have come in the past because we are living in this really shit reality right now. But like even 5 years ago, you could buy things for a quarter of the price that they are now. So I feel that. I would love to walk in and grab a milkshake or whatever with 3 ice cream scoops, pay 5 cents. Like that would be so great. I would love that so much. And just the little scenes, like little moments that really hit. It's like he gives the guy $1 for the thing. And back, you know, from then, like 20 something, 30 years before, like that was a lot of money to pay for just a drink at the ice cream parlor. Little moments like that, I just think are so, so well done. And me, I'm thinking, wow, you could buy a bag of chips for like $1.50. Now you got to spend $8 for the same bag of chips. Like, what is happening? It's interesting how these kind of episodes have made me reflect on different things with different, I guess, nostalgia in a way. I just really loved this episode. I just thought it was so beautifully written. It's so well acted. And I was absolutely caught off guard seeing little tiny Ron Howard show up in a small role, which is kind of cool. I can understand why this has been sort of spoken highly of and voted highly in terms of Twilight Zone episodes. It's not like my favorite, but I really, really just loved this episode quite a lot. It could possibly make my top 10. I just think it's a really freaking good episode. And I think much like with the previous one, just interesting kind of messaging. But I think here it's not the sad kind of ending. I feel like there's more of a hopeful ending for this one. And I know I would be completely freaked out if I went back to my childhood and met child me. I'd be like, get the fuck out of here while you can. I don't want to make it to 26.
Young Martin in this episode did the right thing. Basically, he sees this man who he doesn't realize is an older version of himself, gets freaked out and basically runs away. So he understands stranger danger.
Obviously, like, the people are like, what the fuck is going on? Who's this weird man? But, like, as it goes on, with the parents actually realizing, like, that's him, especially with the dad and the talk that they have, which I just think, for me, that almost like makes the episode as powerful as it is, because I think it's just such a good moment.
There's already enough visual emphasis on that, because by that stage, he's chased down his younger self to the merry-go-round and he accidentally pushes himself down and basically breaks his younger self's leg, or at least damages it to a point where now his present self, who does feel that same pain at the same time, now has a limp, which, again, I love how it's called walking distance, because it's showing how it can be such an easy stride into nostalgia, but then a really hard walk back. I realized, too, while you were talking about the whole money factor of, like, this is kind of an interesting commentary on capitalism. So where nostalgia-wise, it's an obvious commentary, and that's where, like, the kind of happy ending is him realizing that he should move on. His dad's telling him, you should move on. The merry-go-round comes back to life. When his dad leaves and he realizes I should move on, everything just keeps working. But the way that it does comment on how expensive things are in contrast, and how even like stranger danger aspects of, like, he's just an older guy talking to random kids and they're fine with it. But I'm like thinking, if it was my modern, like our modern day here, that wouldn't happen. That'd be weird. I'm like, this guy's hanging out with too many kids. It's weird, but nobody there thinks it's weird.
Yeah, I mean, even, and I feel like this was something I brought up on a previous podcast episode. I can't remember. But like, back to the 80s and like mid 90s, did our parents know where the fuck we were at 11 o'clock at night? No, we got to go play, do whatever the fuck, whatever. Like, we had freedom. Now it's like, oh no, you got to be careful of that weird person just standing there. Like, it's so crazy. Like, even if you watch this 40 years ago, that wouldn't have seemed unusual. Now you watch it with this lens, it's like, yeah, maybe don't talk to the weird man.
I don't know if audiences at the time would have realized it's kind of commentary on, again, the capitalism. Because at least for nostalgia, there's a lot of, again, a lot of Stephen King films, which are very, hey, it's the 80s, but we're doing 50s nostalgia, whatever. And that's exactly what this episode is doing. I just kind of find it really interesting how, like, as much as it does have that more optimistic look of he should move on and carry on with his life, it's also, hey, doesn't capitalism just kind of kill everything? Like, the merry-go-round broke down and stopped working because no one was funding it. Like, things are more expensive now in the present day. There's all those elements that just really are the cynical essence of the actual episode of how that's what's killing culture. It's just money. And that's what makes him so depressed to want to go back to his childhood thing, because he was carefree. He didn't have to worry about it. There was no crime and punishment. It was just fun. And now that's all gone, and you have to pay your bills.
So I feel this episode. I'm like, I want to go back to where I could just wake up, watch music videos, go to the video store, go sit on my Game Boy. Not, I mean, now it's just okay, I'll go to Tubi and I'll play on my computer, but it's not the same. It was so much more socializing back then. And I want to get my three scoops of milkshake with a dime.
I should also mention the aspect of the film, because again, this episode in particular of the three really plays with its visuals. It has a lot of canted angles when he goes to the amusement park, to the merry-go-round, when all the kids leave, there's a spotlight on him, but everyone else is moving away, like literally showing his childhood leaving him or in the past. Like, his childhood is leaving him in the past. That's how much of buried in nostalgia he is. But yeah, no, that's all I got in terms of my notes, especially with it ending with him limping back to his car.
The limp was an interesting aspect. Like, he just gets this because he sort of changed what happened. I like that little element to it as well. B, did you have anything else to add?
Well, I think it's definitely a very interesting episode. Like, watching it, I thought, okay, this is a solid episode. Not an amazing episode, but it's definitely one I'm thinking about a lot since watching it. And I think it's definitely one like the two previous episodes where it's more about the performances, the script, and the themes, rather than doing anything that's kind of got a major twist or something supernatural or frightening. Certainly must have been going through a bit of a nostalgia feel while writing these three episodes, because I just find it weird that all three of the episodes we've talked about for this show today have very similar themes to them and kind of approach them in different ways. So it's kind of interesting, like, in a way, because I know one of the episodes after this one, Escape Clause, deals with bargaining with the devil. So that's clearly not dealing with what we've been talking about here in terms of
I mean, it's
thematic.
almost going back to the Mr. Denton episode where you're given something and it's like, oh, should I be doing that kind of thing? So there's definitely like themes, but I think with each episode kind of having similar themes, that the takeaway from everything is kind of a little bit different and they're not at all like the three episodes are not at all the same. So I like that even though we're dealing with similar themes, they're very different.
Yeah, exactly. Can I blow your mind a little bit, Marcy? So, you've got Martin Landau in Mr. Death. You've got Ron Howard, little baby Ron Howard in Walking Distance. Did you know Ron Howard would direct Martin Landau in the film and TV decades later?
That's one of the cool things about watching The Twilight Zone is to see like who was involved and who might be in an episode. And this one definitely was a great surprise because I was like, oh, it's Martin Landau and oh, it's Ron Howard. And then I'm like, oh, Ida Lupino was in an episode as well as having directed an episode. So it's pretty
And
cool mixture there.
it made me feel old, Marcy, because it made me realize Ron Howard has been around for so long. He was in an episode of the original Twilight Zone.
As a little kid, but he was a child actor.
Yes, that is true.
That can be a wrap on the discussion for this episode. Julian, final thoughts and rating out of five.
I gave it a 4 out of 5. It seems like a simple enough episode walking into it, especially with the obvious commentary on nostalgia and everything, but its utilization of its visuals, its performances especially, just carries it a bit more above the rest. It's most because of its visual language and how it uses its visual motifs. It's a good study episode as much as it is an interesting commentary on just the human condition and capitalism and how it sucks.
Beat.
Yeah, I give it about a 4 out of 5 as well. I think it's a really strong episode that I feel like it kind of culminates all the themes and ideas that Serling was going for with these past three episodes. Like, it all comes together in this one. And I think Gig Young does give a really great performance in this, Marcy. And I had to laugh because you say, like, oh, in the episode, he's meant to be 36 and he looks way older than 36. That's because Gig Young was actually 45 when he filmed this
That
episode.
makes perfect sense.
But I think he's great in it.
Yeah.
The supporting cast are also really solid. And yeah, I think it's just a really good, strong episode that definitely I would put it in up there as one of my personal favorite Twilight Zone episodes, but it definitely is one that at least lives up to its reputation.
And for me, I'm actually giving it 4.5 because I really loved it a lot. Just everything about it. And as you mentioned, Julian, like the visual motifs are just so, they're on the nose, but they're so really well done. So 4.5 stars, absolutely recommend this episode. And the closing narration. Martin Sloane, age 36, which we know is questionable. Vice president in charge of media, successful in most things, but not in the one effort that all men try at some time in their lives, trying to go home again. Perhaps across his mind, there'll flit a little errant wish that a man might not have to become old, never outgrow the parks and the merry-go-rounds of his youth. And he'll smile then too, because he'll know it is just an errant wish, some wisp of memory, not too important really. Some laughing ghosts that cross a man's mind that are part of the Twilight Zone. And speak for yourself, I still do the things I did as a kid, so.
Just without the blissful ignorance that we used to have.
Pretty much. And yeah, that's a wrap on this episode of Podcasters of Horror, discussing these episodes of The Twilight Zone. Thank you to everybody for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you have any suggestions for episodes of any iteration of The Twilight Zone you think would be interesting for us to discuss, please let us know. And you can find us at supermarcy.com, and Podcasters of Horror is available on all your podcast streaming platforms, such as Spotify and Apple Podcasts. So be sure to be subscribed and like and give us a review if you so wish to. And you can keep up to date with all podcasting things that I'm doing by checking me out on social media. I am Super Marcy and Super underscore Marcy on Letterboxd and Beat.
Well, people want to find me personally out there on the internet. You can follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bede Jemine. You can find all my work and all the other podcasts that you and I host together, Marcy, on supermarcy.com and on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Super Podcast or their individual podcast feeds. And also, you can listen to my solo podcast, Bede versus the Living Dead, and its many spin-off shows on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Bede versus the Living Dead podcast feed.
And Julian, where can people check you out and also check out Collector Creations?
Yeah, well, I've got Collector Creations Instagram and Facebook, obviously the YouTube channel, which is the main thing I run. I don't have a podcast like you guys do, but I do have an interview show, so I will plug that interview show because I can do that. But yes, I mostly talk about film and physical media. Yeah.
As Julian said, check it out on YouTube, and you can check out Collector Creations on Facebook and Instagram. And you always post your new pickups. And by the time this episode comes out, this would have been out for a little bit, but you recently did your Kubrick ranking as you watched all of the Kubrick films, and that's a really great watch.
Yeah.
My thoughts with some films are very similar, some are very different. So I always love checking that out. So highly recommend it, and definitely check out the cool interviews you've been doing as well. So be sure to check that out, and keep up to date with that as well. And with that said, we might see you in the Twilight Zone next time, or we may be doing something completely different. We will find out. But just saying, a certain horror anthology show is now officially available for people to watch, and it hasn't been for a long time. So we may be delving into that. And if until next time, just be part of the Twilight Zone, I guess.
Exactly.
Bye.
See you, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you.